Hello, everybody. It's Ty. I don't know why I'm starting this podcast a bit like I'm announcing a boxing match. It's Gareth Beavis here talking to you on the Noise Cancelling Podcast for episode 66. We are talking about entertainment this week.
Dreaming.
Still with tech involved in... What's that?
Dreaming. Films. TV.
Yes. There we go, Tom. You're getting in the way of who's actually here. But let's start there now. Who am I talking to today?
This is Sean O'Connell. I'm the managing editor for Cinema Blend.
And this is Tom Power, entertainment reporter for Tech Radar.
I'm enjoying that this is. That's quite nice. This is Gareth Beavis reporting for Tech Radar, global editor in chief. That's who I am, actually, if you needed help. Cherie is off sick this week, so there'll be no... I'm scared to say there'll be no fun in this podcast because she's the fun one and I'm the mumbly one that no one can understand. But I'm just saying that lots of pressure on both your shoulders. You know, two new versions to this podcast. We're looking forward to seeing what you can bring. Are you excited, Sean?
Yes, I would have brought my clown horn for fun. I wish I had a sound effect board.
Yeah, I wish that all my life, basically. Sean, you've got your own podcast separately, haven't you?
Yes, I do. It's called the Real Blend Podcast, R-E-E-L, because we're clever. We talk about film and entertainment and streaming, and we've become a hub for directors to come on by while they're out promoting stuff, because they typically hate those little 4-minute, 5-minute junket slots. They want to talk at length about their project, and so we give them a half an hour, and we've had people like Christopher Nolan and Quentin Tarantino, Ryan Johnson, a lot of great filmmakers come on by, so check us out.
Yep, and I like the fact that Real Blend and Cinema Blend, there's so much wordplay going on. I enjoy that.
Thank you. Yes.
And Tom, why haven't you got a podcast that's equally successful and amazing?
I don't have a podcast because I don't like the sound of my own voice, so that's my excuse. But I'm on this one now, so we can make this one my podcast.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to usurp and take over, I don't mind. I mean, the easy answer is just get producers to come and do all the checking and editing for you, so you never have to listen to your own voice. That's the smart way to do it.
That's a very good point.
But as we said, we're talking about entertainment, streaming, TV, movies, all the good fun in there. And as usual, we start with a big question. Now, there was a story this week. I'm sure many people have heard about Mark Hamill. He's relatively famous, would we say, guys?
Yes. Yeah.
Just about. Yeah, just possible.
He'd be on a Mount Rushmore of pop culture, I think, for some people.
Do you? Like, he's very one-trick pony, I think.
But what, for Star Wars or for playing the Joker? I'd say they're equally important.
True. Absolutely true. Yeah, good point. I think Star Wars is where he fits in most of the time. But at the moment, he's definitely doing us a bit more because he's joining the machine, the cinematic version of Bert Kreischer's iconic comedy bit. And he's joining as a father. So that led us to question, who would we want to play our fathers in a biopic? Sean, start us off.
Well, he's not an actor. My choice would be Kevin Feige, the president of Marvel Studios. I think he might actually be my father. But since he's not an actor, I won't go with him. I will choose George Clooney. There's no one cooler on screen than George Clooney. And the math checks out. He could be my father. So I'm holding out hope for a DNA test someday. I would just like to raid his closet. I'd like to get into some of the coolest clothes that he's had in his castle in Italy. Oh, also I can hang out at his castle in Italy. That'd be nice.
And also aesthetically it checks out. You know, you've definitely got some Clooney vibes going.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah. I will take that compliment and run with it.
Tom, how about you?
I had to think long and hard about this. And I would probably go for J.K. Simmons just because he seems to have that fatherly instinct about him. So probably him, but only him if he's not doing a Whiplash kind of dad or an Invincible kind of dad. You know, he's got to have some sort of, you know, good relationship with me if he's going to have the privilege of being my father for a film.
I mean, what if he was a Whiplash sort of dad? What would that? How would that land, do you think?
Oh, well, he'd probably get me to play the drums and then scream at me for 2 hours straight and I'd go and cry into a pillow somewhere. So that probably wouldn't be the best idea.
He's making you a better son. Through the process.
That is true, Sean. Yes. That is true, yeah.
It's pushing you to be your best.
Tough love.
Yes.
Essentially, he'll be trying to get you to open a can of beans by yourself soon. Very niche meme for those that followed the internet. I decided that, obviously, in a biopic, I would have to play myself because that's important. I don't want anyone else to get that wrong. And I was thinking, what I really want is somebody who is capable of acting in inverted commas, so not so bad that people would like this was just awful and drew the attention, but wouldn't out act me. And I think John Bon Jovi is where I'd like to go.
Nice. Yeah. I love a good Jersey hairband. I love a good New Jersey hairband.
Exactly. And I feel like, you know, he can act. Is he sensational? No. You know, he's John Bon Jovi. He can sing. He's got great hair. I feel like that's enough for me. And
back in the day, I would have chosen Bruce Willis, but the lack of hair, I think, has scared me off.
I did think Bruce Willis, but then I thought, no, he's, you know, he's kind of had some ropey films lately, so I probably don't really want to associate myself with him too much.
Oh my gosh. Some. That man's career is direct-to-video now at this point. It's embarrassing.
I was being polite about my future father, Sean.
And also Die Hard 5, where he plays a father directly, that was very much like, I can't really cut this anymore. He's like, I'm supposed to be here for a holiday, over and over again, to the point where he wondered if he was just forgotten why he was there and just desperate to have a holiday, you know, rather than it being like a tagline.
Yeah. Wait, there's a fifth Die Hard?
Because you've got such a caliber in film, I was like, is there? Have I counted wrong?
No.
I thought there was.
You're right. I've blocked it out. Yeah. I've chosen to forget that it exists.
But you've got that power to make me question my own existence in the entertainment world. You know, I know about iPhones and stuff. This is me just getting involved in things that I've watched recently. So, okay, cool. I think I'm going to offer the points to Sean. I mean, who wouldn't want to take an espresso with George Clooney and, you know, look at fine suits and what have you?
Thank you.
I mean, really, I'd quite like to see Mark Hamill just be all of our fathers at once and, you know, just make some really great puns. Let's move into, well, is it a hangar? Is it a warehouse? Someone described this to me the other day about as more like the Indiana Jones, where they keep the Ark of the Covenant kind of warehouse. But this is our Hall of Fame, where we're going to put gadgets that we think are worthy of being celebrated and adored. And over in the corner, there's a massive skip where we chuck things like Matt Swider's Tech Radar branded headphones, and as of last week, a broken Fitbit rival Jawbone Up. But we want to hear from our guests either what their first gadget was, the one they loved the most growing up, or just one they feel it should be celebrated for all time. So Tom, kick us off. What are you bringing into the Gadget Hall of Fame, and can you keep it out the skip?
The first one I remember getting was the Sega Game Gear, which I had. I don't know if it was Sonic the Hedgehog or if Sonic the Hedgehog, like one of the spin-off series, but there was also a game that was like...
There was Sonic, definitely.
It was a game based around the Tasmanian Devil, you know, from Looney Tunes, and like he was doing some like 2D platformer in space where he had to go and rescue someone from Marvin the Martian. It sounds like a lucid dream, but I swear it's an actual game. So yeah, that was probably the first gadget that I remember getting.
The Game Gear was absolutely underrated. It was one of those, you see this so many times where the superior technology doesn't make it, you know, it had color screen. You could flip and put a TV antenna in the back of it and use it as a portable TV.
There was so much you could do with it. You know, it just feel like it obviously came out around the same time that the Game Boy exploded as well. So, you know, it was having to fight on the Nintendo front, as a home console and as a handheld console. So, yeah, that's probably the one I'd go for. Whether it deserves to actually stay out of the bin, that's up to the audience to decide. But I definitely would keep it out.
Sean?
Okay, so I am a guitar player in my... like as a hobby on the side, and I played my entire life, but I grew up playing punk rock, and so I never really cared if strings were in tune. I just played fast and loud. It didn't really matter to me. But then I met a guy who was my college roommate, and he played all sorts of classical guitar and was way more into the instrument and would spend most of his time tuning, and I never understood why, because I didn't necessarily care. But I eventually got introduced to this amazing little gadget. Mine is called the Snark Man. I don't really know what it's called, but you put it on the end of your guitar, and the vibrations from the neck of the guitar tell you the tune of your string. And so it's extremely easy, whether you have an ear for it or not. I would kind of just tune by ear, and it would be off by just enough that it bothered my college roommate and really close friend. And so he turned me on to this device. And this device is really, like, I'll admit, when you play your guitar in tune, it does sound much better. And so it has allowed me to play songs that sound like the songs. And it's such a simple device. It can just sit on the top of your guitar. You kind of forget that it's there after a while. And in between songs, you just press this little red button, and it will tell you whether the strings you are playing are the notes that they are supposed to be. Clever gadget. Whoever invented it is a genius, and it's changed the way I play music.
I mean, how would you describe it to the listeners who unfortunately can't see this beautiful stream we're on?
It has a tiny clip And then a circular little head that sort of extends out, and the head has a visual screen on it. But somehow the vibration that comes from your guitar as you're playing it, it will tell you on like a little meter that goes back and forth what string you're supposed to be playing, whether it's an E, an A, a G, a D. It is it's no bigger than, you know, it fits in the palm of your hand, which means you can lose it very easily, as I have multiple times. But it's a simple little device that just keeps your instrument in tune.
I feel like if you, to draw some synergy with Tom there, if you put some big white and black eyes on there and a nice helmet, it would look like Marvin the Martian.
It very much would, yes. The face of it looks very Looney Tunes-esque. And especially the clip has a sort of mouth element to it. You could, again, this is a visual that I'm doing for an audio podcast. But this is for the benefit of you guys, because I want you to feel special that you're part of the show.
And we do. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So the Game Gear is an iconic piece of tech. As I said, you could watch TV on it. It had arguably, like, in my mind, a very long time ago, had Mega Drive or Genesis level of graphics on it. It was brilliant. And like I said, it was far superior to the Game Boy and is cruelly underdone. However, Tom sold it so badly. And Sean had such a passion for how this could create music and beauty and just art around the world just for this clip, and obviously gave it some animation itself, that I'm chucking the Game Gear in the bin, Tom. I'm sorry.
Sean's done this before. That's my excuse.
True. Yeah, exactly. But I feel like all you had to do was go, this is really good, Gareth. You should keep it. You were just like, I don't even believe it myself. So you've let down Sega as a whole entity. You okay with that?
Never mind. I'm sure the live stream on their Sonic stuff tomorrow will make up for it.
Yeah, I mean, the whole Sonic is a whole different thing. Let's not ruin elements of this podcast for later. Let's go straight into what's going on. We're here to talk about entertainment. We're here to talk about streaming. We're here to talk about movies and film and all the bits and pieces in there. But before we get into what's happening right now, I want to hear from you guys again. I mean, Sean, you've already alluded to the fact that you've talked to some incredible directors, and I'm assuming obviously actors as well have come through as well, and you mentioned press junkets, and you know, I've only seen these from afar. You know, as a tech writer, we don't generally get the same thing where you're paraded past, you know, a product designer of the new iPhone and they'll go like 5 minutes to ask some questions. It's much more technical specs and trying to work out if you're a good journalist or not. But in terms of the junkets you've done, like, what's the best or worst that you've ever had the pleasure of being part of?
Well, this has been really tough in the time of COVID and the world shutting down, because we've had to learn how to do the junkets. Haven't stopped because people are still out promoting stuff, but you're learning how to do it via Zoom, and that's become super uncomfortable. Tom, I know you have some experience with this as well too, where you get dropped into a Zoom room, and there on the other end of the screen is essentially someone who you might deeply admire. You know, I brought up George Clooney as my imaginary father. I've got to interview him twice while we're in COVID restrictions, because he was promoting.
Did you call him dad?
I didn't. I held off until he logged off, and then I said goodbye, dad.
Don't want to scare him off
real quickly. It was in a sad kind of way. But you know, I've had really great junket experiences. The best ones are when the people are super engaged and want to talk about, you know, the project that they're working on. The worst ones are when they don't. And, you know, it can be a chore for them to, because quite often people ask this, like, if it's a really bad movie, does it make for a hard interview? And it doesn't. It allows you to sort of veer off and talk about other things you might be interested in their lives. And more often than not, they know that it's a bad movie, you know, so they don't really try to not do the dance, essentially. But the worst interview I've ever had, I had a horrible, horrible experience with Anne Hathaway. Which has a really long backstory to it. So I'll just chalk it up to the fact that she was having a really horrible day. The one that I want to single out, though, and I hate to do this because we started off by talking about how great Mark Hamill is, but Harrison Ford gave me the worst interview of my entire journalism career. And he was promoting a movie called, I want to say it was called Firewall or something. One of those Harrison Ford movies that you just forget that he's even in it a year or so after you've seen it.
Crystal Skull?
Yes. this was worse than Crystal Skull, to tell you how bad it is. And my issue with it was that he just gave me one or two word answers. You know, yeses and noes, or I don't really think about it that way. Like, no answers. And when it ended, I kind of thought, like, you're Harrison Ford. Like, you don't have to do press if you don't want to. You have the ability to turn around to the studio and just say, I'm not promoting this movie. You know, forget it. Let Paul Bettany or whoever the co-star was do all the interviews. But he did them.
It was Paul Bettany.
If you're going to, yeah, well, I mean, no respect to, no, all due respect to Paul Bettany, who's fantastic, but I think he was in Firewall. So that will always go down as my worst interview experience because it shouldn't have happened. If you're going to do the interviews, do the interviews. And he decided to do the interviews but not partake, and that was frustrating.
What did Anne Hathaway do to you?
In a long story short, it was for Rio 2, an animated movie, where she's just the voice of an animated character.
Great film.
And interviewing an actor for an animated film is hard enough as it is because they're not really giving a performance. They're just lending their voice to an animated movie. And this junket was in Miami, and it was supposed to be outdoors. And if anybody knows anything about Florida, it rains often. So a huge storm came through, and the studio had to move everything from outside to inside, which was enormously challenging for the tech people to have to set up this new interview suite for them to make it look palatable for them to sell. But Anne Hathaway decided she still wanted to start on her normal time. So she showed up at the room while they were still building it, putting it together, and wanted to begin, which is her right to do. And so the studio furiously called every journalist they could and asked them, like, can you start now? So I foolishly said, sure, I can start now. And I walked right into the lion's den because she was not happy. Everything was sort of delayed. The room was a bit of a mess. I tried to make small talk. It went completely dead. And the longer that the tech people took to put everything together, the more annoyed she got. So when we officially started the interview, I lobbied my first question to her. And the answer I got back was silence. And then, why on earth would you ask me that question? And I wanted to, and this was after, again, a good 20 minutes of us just small talking, you know, and really me small talking and her kind of just cold shouldering me. Mm-hmm. And then that was the reply I got. And I wanted to bolt from the room immediately. So it was pretty bad.
I mean, you should just drop it about the fact your dad's George Clooney. I feel like let's just start spinning that around the industry.
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah, exactly. You know, some of the same letters in your last name. People would just go, well, that kind of makes sense.
It sounds like a lawsuit waiting to happen, Gareth.
No, that's a good point. I keep forgetting about those things. Tom, have you got anything less litigious?
Not really. I've been quite lucky with the interviews that I've had. Just going back to a point that Sean made earlier about the virtual junkets, though, that's really been difficult way, you know, to do these things. Like Sean said, they still need to do these junkets to promote new movies and TV shows. But it's very difficult from the standpoint that, as Sean alluded to, with Anne Hathaway, and obviously there'll be better experiences than that. You always want to build a rapport with the people that you're going to be interviewing before you interview them. It helps to break the ice and give you an idea, you know, of the kind of stuff that they're interested in, you're interested in, and the kind of questions that you're going to ask them, and what you might want to discard if they are having a particularly bad day. But yeah, with the junkets over Zoom and other apps like it, it's very difficult to go into those interviews with any sort of without going into them cold, I guess, because it's very much a case of you're dropped into these rooms, and we're recording straight away, so state your name, state your outlets, and get straight into your interview. And you might only have 5, maybe 10 minutes max to ask the questions that you have to do. So you're always keeping an eye on the clock and trying to determine, you know, which questions you want to ask and which ones might follow up best to answers that they give you naturally. So there's a whole host of issues that come with virtual junkets, and you know, it's my hope that once economies start opening up and we hopefully start getting in-person events again, you know, that we get back into that cycle of doing those face-to-face interviews rather than ones that, you know, that are kind of behind a computer screen at someone who's halfway across the world.
I mean, one of the reasons that TechRadar does so much entertainment content is because just the rise of streaming and Netflix and Amazon Prime Video and Hulu and Disney Plus and so many now, where you can just, it still upsets me. I mean, I don't know what a collective age is, but there are far too many 10-year-olds who don't understand what it's like to not have access to any song, any film, any TV show. Now, just by saying it to certain devices, I'm like, I want to watch this now and see it. And you know, you couldn't watch anything unless you had a VHS of it that someone had copied off the TV or blah, blah, blah. You know, like, it's just such a different world. They don't understand how important it is to want these things. But that world does exist now. I mean, have you, Tom, seen any difference in the way that actors have been handling themselves, given the fact that films are now coming out on streaming services rather than in cinema? Is there less of a kind of excitement to it or what?
I don't necessarily think excitement. I think, as Sean said, you know, if the people you're interviewing are passionate about the project that they're doing or the project that they're promoting, they're going to be excited about it anyway. So it's not necessarily a case of, you know, you're going to be greeting them or meeting them where they're not, you know, in a good place in terms of, you know, promoting that movie. But there are occasions where, you know, or individuals, like we had the whole Martin Scorsese thing with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There are directors and there are actors who probably see theatrical releases and cinema releases as the pure form of releasing that kind of content. So from a streaming perspective, whilst it's a lot easier for audiences to consume in that manner, particularly in their own home, there's probably still a little bit of a little bit of negativity with some people in terms of bringing the big tempo releases to the likes of Amazon Prime Video or a Netflix, particularly if they're movies that are supposed to have come out theatrically, particularly in the last year, and then they've ended up being having the rights bought by one of these big streaming services just in order to get the movie out there. So there's definitely been a shift in terms of the landscape with bigger releases coming to streaming platforms, whether that's something that will be, you know, a big thing in 10, 20 years, and that'll be the place where everybody goes for their big movies, remains to be seen. But we'll probably get into that in more detail later on anyway.
Well, let's do it now. I mean, Sean, like, you're editor of Cinema Blend. The word cinema's there. I mean, I don't know how long it took you, but does the smell of popcorn, does the feel of the lights dimming, is that something that you still get excited about? Or is the fact that you can now watch things at home more regularly like everybody else a good thing?
Both. It's kind of both. I mean, I'll never not love the theatrical going experience. And there's definitely movies that are coming out that I know I would want to experience in a movie with other people. One in particular is Quiet Place Part 2. Like, I've been lucky enough to see that.
Yeah.
The way that it's designed, from its use of sound to, ironically, you know, its use of silence, is just more effective in a dark movie theater. You know, you're going to, and the beauty of the first Quiet Place was how the audience kind of participated with that, you know, like people went out of their way to make sure that everyone in the theater was really quiet to get the best experience out of it. But I'd be lying if I said that I didn't also love the fact, you know, that something like Mortal Kombat, which in, you know, the before days, I would have gone to the theater to go see. But I was very content on a Friday night to just be like, oh, cool, this is on HBO Max also. I'll just put it on. And, you know, we've even had a conversation on our podcast, on the Real Blend podcast, where one of my co-hosts, Kevin McCarthy, has as many DVDs, you know, around him. His basement is essentially like a Blockbuster Video. Still, he's super into physical media. And we have a discussion all the time that if he wants to watch something, he will go out of his way to pull the DVD off the shelf and put it on because he thinks the transfer is better on a Blu-ray. But I have gotten used to, and especially I have two teenage boys and there might be something I want to show them from, you know, we watched The Lost Boys, Joel Schumacher's vampire movie, because my 13-year-old hadn't seen it yet. And I'm telling you, there's no way to not love just pushing the microphone button on your remote control and saying Lost Boys. And then it shows up on your TV. Yeah. Like, do I understand that it's cheating? Yeah, I do. But like, that's technology now. It's kind of great. And why not take advantage of that?
I absolutely, we were doing some side-by-side comparisons and I still believe, I haven't empirically solved this, but that 4K Blu-ray, which is so niche still, is still better than 4K streaming on the TV. Even if you've got HDR and you've got Dolby Atmos and all these great things, it's still, I do think the physical media still has a lot to say for it. It's interesting when you said at The Quiet Place, I really want to go and see that in the cinema. I'm glad that there should be the opportunity to do that eventually one day, hopefully soon. But I remember seeing Dolby have a cinema in London that's like the test cinema for all the different things they could do. And I saw Gravity there. And it was also when 3D was trying to be a thing. And they'd done it well, like Dolby Vision and 3D plus the Dolby Atmos. When Dolby Atmos was just the thing we come out, and if you haven't heard about it, Dolby Atmos is this idea that you sit sort of in a soundscape. So this cinema had about 120 speakers, so that it wasn't just like, you know, surround sound that comes from behind you or in front of you or to the side. It's literally degrees around, so you feel so immersed. And oh my God, like I've never ever been so tense in a film.
Yep.
Than watching Gravity, and like genuinely had to unclench my butt twice just to, like, physically do it, like, and relax. I was like, they're in space and she's gonna get killed, and it's swinging around, and you know, Sean's dad's there and he's got lost in, you know, I can't say, but yeah.
But think about it, Alfonso Cuarón made that movie knowing that that was going to be the presentation, right? Like, he made it for a big screen, for an IMAX and for the Dolby Atmos. But not every movie is made with that intention, you know. Like, Fast and Furious has F9 coming out. If you want to go see that, you probably want to see it on a big screen, because that's the way to take in, you know, a huge, big, dumb blockbuster. If you watch it at home, it's not going to have the same impact. Carry on. Yeah, that's fair enough. But, you know, if Meryl Streep, you know, makes a quiet little family, you know, drama, you don't necessarily need it. So I wonder what I'm saying is if moving forward, filmmakers will approach movies that they know are going to go to streaming in a different way than they approach the movies that they are guaranteed to go to the big screen, because the way that something like Gravity, the way that Quiet Place takes advantage of the sound systems and the darkness and the ability to manipulate a crowd, they might put more thought into that process, and it might change the way that movies are made and definitely presented as we move forward.
And Tom, do you trust movie theaters movie studios to create the things in the right place? So, you know, as Sean said, the ones that would fit better on the smaller screen, you know, will be presented and offered in streaming, and the big blockbusters will always be held sacrosanct on the big screen for a little bit longer. Or do you think it's just like, well, we can make more money if we just put it everywhere, and then the viewer has to decide, and eventually we're all lazy and we just start destroying cinema?
I'd like to think that the big tentpole ones will still be released theatrically. I mean, we've seen that there are plans. I think it's Marvel's Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings is getting an exclusive 45-day theatrical release before it comes to, or potentially comes to, Disney Plus. Whether that's going to be the blueprint moving forward for big tempo releases, we'll have to wait and see. But I definitely like to see those big blockbuster movies retain that theatrical experience. Like Sean said, you want to be able to go to theatres or cinemas and see the likes of Godzilla versus Kong or Avengers Endgame on the big screen with people around you, and have that shared experience. It's not necessarily the same as watching it at home. You know, even if you could have a watch party at home, whether it's done virtually or in person once things improve, but it will never be the same as watching it in a cinema with 300 other people and all marveling at the same thing, or being shocked by the same scene, or all cheering and clapping at the same moment. So I would like to hope that that'll be the case. Whether that does remain the case, like I say, we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, you would like to hope, especially with everywhere opening up now and the likes of A Quiet Place 2 coming out in the cinema, and you know, we've got Black Widow coming out in the summer, and a load of other summer blockbusters which will be getting theatrical releases. So I think the future's still bright for the theatrical experience. And
but do you trust the movie theaters? Do you trust the studios? Do you think they're going to do the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's no real reason why they shouldn't. They'll still make money whether they bring it to cinemas or streaming platforms. You know, there's if there's an audience for it, I still think that I still trust them to bring it to the cinema. There's no reason why they shouldn't. And I think, you know, the people in charge of certain properties, like the Marvel movies, like Kevin Feige, like that kind of experience anyway. So, you know, if studio heads are happy to carry on moving forward with the theatrical experience and releasing the movies that way, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't continue.
I'll tell you, there's a balance that's happening as well too. Sorry, Gareth, where the streaming services who are partnering with certain filmmakers are being way more flexible. Like Netflix is allowing Zack Snyder's Army of the Dead to play in limited theaters for a week before it goes to the streaming service. These are directors, a filmmaker like Zack Snyder, a filmmaker like Christopher Nolan, they're always going to fight for the theatrical going experience. But they realize that the landscape is changing and they have to concede a little bit, right? So, and the streaming services realize also, in order to get these filmmakers to come collaborate with us, we're going to have to concede some points also. So yes, we will allow Army of the Dead, which is a movie that probably plays better in a crowd, you know, on a big screen. Yes, go out and play a theatrical run, limited, and then come back to Netflix. So you get both options. You're getting the best of both worlds. And it's ridiculous now that that's a reality, because 2 years ago, I would have told you that that would never be the case. But the industry is changing rapidly just to react to the situation that we all find ourselves in. So I'm going to be fascinated to see how it continues to evolve.
Do you think all the movie studios could have their own streaming platforms eventually, or that it's just too many?
Well, the only one that doesn't have any form at all right now is Sony.
Hmm.
The other ones have them, whether they're effective or not. Well, actually, Universal has a day and date, 17-day window now where stuff can go to paid streaming afterwards. And they have, I guess they could start using Peacock. But, you know, Paramount Plus and Peacock are much smaller than the HBO Maxes and the Disney Pluses of the world. Those two have just come out of the gate sort of roaring. I think Sony eventually is going to have to come up with some sort of distribution model. But so the only IP that Sony really has going for it is Spider-Man.
Mm.
And they just signed that deal to have the Spider-Man films go to Disney Plus. So it's almost like these are all weird negotiations that are happening. Like Sony movies are going to be available on Disney Plus. The line is blurring, you know, just so that these studios can stay in business. And I find that to be really fascinating, because the politics in Hollywood normally would keep the studios very clearly separated and their properties defined in a specific way. And now everybody's sort of sharing with everyone else.
We talked just now about, we mentioned Mortal Kombat. Sonic made a brief blue blur speeding past moment. I mean, is it the case where video game films are starting to become a thing? Because I'm just thinking Mortal Kombat and Sonic, we've written about these, obviously Tech Radar, there's gaming, there's entertainment, it's all a good fusion. But are they getting good? I mean, Sonic got absolutely panned when it first came out, and I've got half the team now, I don't know if they're tongue-in-cheek or genuinely think it was a good film, talking about the sequel quite happily. But Mortal Kombat was massive, and I remember the Mortal Kombat films when I was younger, and they were shit. But I still love them. So, I mean, are they getting better now? Are we in the new world, Tom?
It's hard to say. I don't necessarily say they're getting better. I think there's probably now a market for them. Now that we've seen a few come out, and, you know, they've got a decent reception based on the trailers that have come out. Whether that's enough to actually say that they are getting better, I guess that's up to individual viewers. Personally, I think there's probably still a way to go on that front.
Which is better, Sonic film or the Mario Brothers film?
Sonic? Probably. I guess the thing will be what happens with the new Super Mario Brothers film that's coming out that Nintendo are doing with Illumination Entertainment, who did Despicable Me and Minions. If that ends up being a massive success for Nintendo, even if it is a CGI movie, then I think we'll see more of them. If that ends up, you know, being a less well-received movie, then I think there'll be still a long way down the road until, you know, we get a very, very good video game adaptation movie.
I mean, yeah, you're wrong. I mean, Super Mario Brothers, to say anything else is better is sacrilegious, because it was a beautifully terrible film. It was beautifully terrible. And I was someone who was so into Mario Brothers when that film came out, and it was so confusing that it wasn't the same. But I felt like I'd seen behind the curtain. I was like, that's what their world is really like. This is amazing. Not, you know, it's a terrible film and it should be thrown in the bin. But it's to CGI that is, unless they do a CGI version, like shot by shot of that one, like they did with The Lion King, but real action. That's what I want to see.
You might get your wish. You never know.
I find it interesting that the games have become more cinematic in nature. And then in turn, the movies are turning around and adapting games that have gone cinematic. Uncharted being one of those examples. Like Uncharted, when I play an Uncharted game, I feel like I'm watching a much longer movie. Last of Us, you know, is a story that the people who play it are extremely protective of the story. Now that's going to become a series, you know, and I think that the story sort of warrants it. But it's been interesting to see how, and then Metal Gear, you know, they're going to try to put the world of Metal Gear together onto the screen. And so, you know, I think that these games that have much longer stories that are baked into them lead to better game properties. When you're just trying to take a game that doesn't necessarily have a large narrative component behind it and try to add stuff to it, I think that's when you lose the faithful fans.
Yeah, I completely agree. I feel that's what stopped me playing games as much. They've got too cinematic. There's too much effort involved. You know, life gets in the way, and I feel really sad because I miss out on all these kind of grand experiences, like say The Last of Us 2 and people talking about what comes in there. But I feel like I'm just not good enough to be part of the film because I don't, you know, can't move fast enough. I can't choose the right things.
Well, wasn't that the knock on Red Dead Redemption Part 2? That it was like too complicated. You had to live the life of a cowboy, essentially.
Yeah, to groom too many horses. Yeah,
yeah.
You know, horse grooming is important for everyone out there who's got a pony. So do listen to that. Finally, before we move on to our final game, if you had the control of the entire industry, Tom, in 10 years' time, how would we be watching movies? And you can do anything. You can do some hologram shit. You can make people fly. You know, what are you going to do to make movie experiences that much better? I mean, flying would be awful. Don't do that. That's a terrible idea.
I don't necessarily feel like it's going to be more hologram based. I think probably they'll move more into the virtual reality space where, you know, people could end up wearing headsets and watching a movie that way. Or, you know, even...
Would you want people to be able to do that, though?
I guess...
You're in charge here. Come on. You're Thanos.
Maybe. I mean, there's an audience there for gaming wise, you know, especially from a first person perspective. You know, people want to feel like they're the hero of a story. So I feel like if you could integrate that into a movie and make the person with the VR headset on the hero of the particular movie that they're watching, that might be a fascinating way for it to go. I don't necessarily know about hologram technology. I don't think that's probably the way forward for the industry. But I think that, you know, from a VR perspective, there's definitely a market there for it. And I think that could potentially be the next step in terms of, you know, integrating fans and making them the center of movies that are produced down the line.
I mean, I've watched films in virtual reality, and I'll be honest, it is exhausting because you never know. You have to obviously, the whole thing, it's like with 3D when they poke sticks out of the screen and you go, oh, I'm going to get hit by a train or whatever. You know, in VR, it was constantly trying to trip you up and make you realize the action was behind you. And you turn around, you'd see it and you'd watch it. It's just, oh, I can't be bothered. Like, it's too much. It's just too much effort. And there's also the element of, if you make people the hero, you have to give them some ability to make the choices rather than just being on a rail where they just watch things happening. And then you basically made a game. And that's the difficulty. I do love it. I mean, VR, as if you've listened to this podcast many times, I love VR. It's brilliant. It's just still not good enough. I just really want it to work. And I don't know if film would be it, but if they could make it work, and if Tom, in 10 years' time, you're doing that, thank you very much, because I would love you for that. I mean, Sean, have you ever watched a film in VR?
Not an entire film, no, but I've played some video games in VR, and I agree that it's fantastic. When it works the way that they want it to work, it's a ton of fun. It's super innovative and new, and it feels like you're trying something fresh. Tom and I were talking about before the show started that we're both enormous Spider-Man fans. I've played a Spider-Man VR game that literally makes me feel like I'm on top of a rooftop and looking around New York City, and that's unbelievable. Yes, I love that we live in a time where that's even remotely possible, even if, you know, it doesn't work as well as I want it to. It works good enough that I, you know, that I'm happy that I got a chance to experience it.
VR is still so gimmicky at times, but like, I think PSVR had the Arkham Asylum where you just play Batman, and there's a bit at the start where they clearly are trying to make it so that you can just enjoy the thrill of being part of the virtual reality experience, where you get to put on all the gauntlets and stuff, then look at yourself in the mirror and you're like, I'm Batman.
That's
like,
awesome. That's awesome. It's just, good enough.
Yeah, exactly. And even that was like one throwaway thing about the rest of the game. I didn't care. But that was enough to make me go, oh, VR is great, isn't it? VR is just really good. And I want it to make it happen. And I was Batman for a bit. And it was really true.
I played some pretty good Star Wars ones as well, too, where, you know, you're working on the Millennium Falcon, and then stormtroopers come over the ridge and are attacking you, and you have to pick up a lightsaber and deflect their blasts. And I literally felt like I was doing it. It's amazing. It's amazing.
There's so many things in VR. There's just even just ones that have got sort of space games where you just got a shield in one hand and a sword in the other, and you're just hitting things and ducking. It's incredible. Now I get angry every week we talk about VR and it's not good enough. I can't just go home to the holodeck that's a spare room in my house and just go and experience this, because it should be here by now. They promised it 10 years ago. It's still not made it. Anyway, right, before we leave, well, usually we play Beeble Trends at this point, but I feel like because we're an entertainment-based show today, I feel like we should go a bit further and talk about movies a bit more. However, you two are both far better at the genre than I am. So what I've done is I found a website that's got 100 fun movie trivia questions with answers to stump all your film-loving friends. I believe that you could probably do 90% of them. So I'm going to try and pick the 10 hardest here and see if you've got... I'm interested to see if I just absolutely know nothing about film, whether they actually are hard questions. So I'll start with one that might be easy, and you can discuss this between yourselves. For what movie did Tom Hanks score his first Academy Award nomination?
I know that.
Is it Forrest Gump?
Can I just answer? It's Big, right?
Yep. Okay. Tom, you should have just said yes. He was really confident. It would have helped. okay. What 1927 musical was the first talkie, in inverted commas?
I don't know. That's way before my time.
Are you saying it's not before Sean's time?
I want to say it's The Jazz Singer. Is that right?
Oh, we're in trouble, Tom. This guy, he knows it. All right, then. How about this one? What was the flavor of Pop-Tart that Buddy the Elf enjoyed in Elf? In the spaghetti. He uses it in his spaghetti.
I think it was chocolate.
Yeah, chocolate, wasn't it? Because he makes some like M&M syrupy mess, doesn't he? Yeah, I would say chocolate.
Fine. Yep. Well done. This is definitely easier than I thought. That's good. here's a really good example of one that I didn't know, and clearly you're both going to. So what TV show was Jack Nicholson referencing when he ad-libbed, "Here's Johnny in The Shining"?
Oh, The Tonight Show.
Yeah. Well done.
With Johnny Carson.
Yeah,
it was.
right, I'm going to ask one more because I'm getting absolutely hammered here. And I thought, oh, that's a difficult one. No one will know that one. That's fine. Right, let me see if I can find the next one I think was going to be difficult, but I don't trust myself with any of these.
These are great, though.
Thank you. You're doing really well. You're like, yeah, I know this really well. I'm an absolute genius, so no wonder you feel brilliant.
They don't let anyone run Cinema Blend, Gareth.
I know. Well, okay. Three of Jim Carrey's blockbusters, The Mask, Dumb and Dumber, and Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, were all released in which year?
95.
And I knew this one.
95?
90. Oh, you might be right. I think it's 93.
Make a choice. You got to agree.
I'll say 93.
Tom, are you going with him? Are you going 95 or are you going 93?
I'll say it was 95.
Wow, joke's on you. It's 94, and I knew that one.
You should have split our differences, Sean.
Yes, I know, Tom. I know.
For some reason, I got really into Jim Carrey as a 12-year-old, so that's why I knew exactly when it was landing.
That's basically because Jim Carrey is a 12-year-old, though.
Let's take a minute and appreciate that he put those three movies out in one year.
Yeah,
come on.
I mean, yeah, I thought it shows how like time is condensed when you're that age. That in my mind, Dumb and Dumber came out about 3 years later, but it's just so quick.
December,
you know, in the same way that you don't realize. Oh, look at you, and that you show that the Spice Girls only were around for 2 years, and you think, no, that was part of a good part of my childhood. So that must have been at least 10 years. But no, time is different, and obviously COVID's ruined everything. Right, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us and listening to this this special entertainment version of the Noise Cancelling Podcast. Sean, have you had a good time?
I've had a wonderful time, yes. And I dominated trivia, so I'm getting my day off started on the right foot.
You're on your day off and you're coming to do our podcast. I didn't realize this. You are a true gentleman. Thank you.
That's how dedicated I am.
And how can people hear more, read more from you?
Well, I'm on Cinema Blend every single day, so make sure you check out cinemablend.com. The Real Blend podcast is available wherever you get your podcast needs met. We also have a YouTube channel where we have a video version of the show, and you can watch most of the people that we interview in person. So go to Real Blend, R-E-E-L, B-L-E-N-D, and then... I'm on social media, Sean_O'Connell.
And Tom, how about you?
You can find me on TechRadar, techradar.com.
Great site.
/author/TomPower. I'm also on all the socials at Thomp1987, THOMP1987. So give me a follow and I'll tell you all about my terrible opinions.
I mean, I feel like you should say it Thomp. Thomp is better. It sounds a bit like Thwomp, which is one of the greatest words of all time.
Such a good word. Linking it back to Mario. Good way to end.
Exactly, right? And I've been Gareth Beavis, Super Beav, and you can also read me on that website, TechRadar. I enjoyed, Tom, how you read out most of the URL for your name. That's really nice for people to properly go through and maybe add in the HTTPS as well, //. But yeah, do look at TechRadar on all the socials. It is TechRadar. It's very easy, ideally, except for TikTok, where we didn't manage to get it because someone has taken it. Do listen to the podcast every week. Subscribe if you haven't, and give us a 5-star rating if you liked it on Apple Podcasts. That helps people find and listen to us. But again, thank you very much for listening to episode 66 of the Noise Cancelling Podcast. Been some great guests. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Sean. And we'll speak to you next week. Bye.